Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we begin the show by talking about life in the driftless area of Wisconsin. And Reggie McLeod back with us, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. So I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe you live in the driftless area. What's been happening around your area? Tell us, we're going to be talking about ferries. Maybe you've got an experience with the ferries on the Mississippi, or what do you want to know about their history on the Mississippi? Lots of things to talk about. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Reggie McLeod, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be back.
You know, I was reading your January-February issue, and right off the bat in your letter from the editor, you call 2024 the year of the refuge, and it's the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge's 100th anniversary. And maybe talk about why I was amazed at I had forgotten how enormous this refuge is, but why is it so important for us to celebrate and protect it in the future?
Well, it's kind of interesting. We kind of forget about it because it's one of those things that's so large you don't see it.
Yeah, right.
It's 261 miles of the river, so it starts right at the bottom of Lake Pepin, where the Chippewa River flows into the Mississippi, and it goes almost down to the Quad Cities, where the Wapsipinicon River flows into the Mississippi. And, it's huge. It's 240,000 acres of land, and it's important because in much of the rest of the river, they've built dikes and then pumped the water out of the bottomland to grow crops. And so you don't have the islands and the backwater channels and backwater lakes that you have on this stretch of river. I mean, this is, I believe, the best stretch of river of the whole Mississippi because of those backwaters and the islands and such. And it was saved 100 years ago because businessman and sportsman from Chicago, Will Doak, liked to come out here and hunt and fish, and he saw that it was being threatened by development, and he formed the Isaac Walton League and lobbied Congress. I think it took him about a week to lobby Congress and get the law passed that preserved the refuge, and it's almost miraculous, and it's still there. And it's so many people that live on this stretch of the river in four states, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois. They enjoy it. You can go out there and camp for free. You don't need a pass or a sticker or, you know, pay a fee. It's just an amazing resource for the whole upper Midwest, and it's even more amazing for all the birds and the fish that use it. I mean, it's probably critical for, millions of animals that use it.
Absolutely. Can you imagine? No, I can't. You can't. I don't think you could imagine somebody going to Congress and in a week getting approval on 261 miles along a river.
Well, getting approval on anything, frankly. Those were different times.
Oh, man.
Say that, yeah.
And there are a lot of, you highlight, it's kind of nice, you highlight many events that are going to be happening in celebration of the refuge.
Yeah, it's the first big event is going to be on March 9th in Lansing, Iowa, which is right across from DeSoto, Wisconsin. And there's a gentleman there who grew up in the Onalaska, Wisconsin area, Steve Marking, who has a show where he kind of becomes Will Doak and talks about the refuge and how it was formed. It's kind of like a, you know, one of those Mark Twain shows that you put together. And he's been working on that and a movie that he's going to, I don't think he's going to show the movie on the 9th, but, you know, we're going to add events all year. There'll be things going on all year, and there's a good website where you can really kind of keep up with these events. And if you Google UpperMiss100.com is the address for it, but if you Google Upper Mississippi Refuge Anniversary or anything like that, you're probably going to be sent there too.
Yeah,
and that's changing constantly. We're going to be adding to it throughout the year.
It's a really, really cool event. Ross in Crawford County has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry and Reggie. Reggie, we got my friend and I, we have a subscription to the Cedar River Magazine. It's really cool. It's really great. You do an amazing work. You probably got to hire more people to do all the work that you do. I've got property over in Crawford County, more on the east end, but I'm, you know, sort of near Linksville when I get over to the big river. What it is, and if anybody's listening, it's never been to the Driftless, you have to come. It's just this amazing, beautiful area. And I think, in my mind, part of the reason that makes it so beautiful, it's unique, you know, geology and stuff. But, I think it's because agriculture wasn't able to completely sort of use everything, take everything. You know, so there's these hills, there's these valleys where, you know, modern agriculture just can't get to. The Amish can kind of work it, but in small farms. But so it sort of preserves this. It has this older feeling to it. That's kind of the main feeling that I have about this area. It really is. It's just a beautiful area.
Ross, thanks. Reggie, I imagine you're going to agree with that.
Well, I certainly do. there is agriculture in the area, of course, but there are smaller fields because we have these dramatic, you know, 400, some of the bluffs are more than 400 feet high, and steep land that really can't be farmed, so it's wooded and has a lot of wildlife. And a lot of the fields are really small, especially when you're close to the river. So that makes it pretty inefficient to use the huge machines that a lot of farmers use now. So it helps Amish people fit in nicely. They can work it very efficiently. And there's a lot of organic agriculture going on in the Driftless area because of that, too. You know, it's not the big production stuff. And it's a lot of nice trout streams because of the a lot of springs and
it's not only beautiful place.
But I used to live down in Brownsville Township in Minnesota, and I think that township was about 60% wooded at least, and that's cool. You don't find many places like that, especially in this area outside of the Driftless area.
Yeah. Ross, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we have I always enjoy going through the recent news from your region, which you usually always highlight in the magazine. We have a lot of listeners in Minnesota, and there are some important environmental updates for well owners there. The EPA, sort of in no uncertain comments, had some words for the state of Minnesota and told them what they needed to do.
Yeah, it's environmental enforcement is a very complicated thing politically because a lot of times it adds expenses to developments that involve a lot of jobs and money. And so it's a little awkward sometimes for the state agencies to be aggressive as perhaps a lot of people would like them to be. And I think in this case, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency was seen by a lot of rural people, actually, as kind of dragging their feet on protecting the groundwater. And so the Environmental Protection Agency came in and said, you know, they've got to figure it out and get to work on it. So I think a lot of people, in fairness, I'll bet a lot of people in the Pollution Control Agency like that, because that gives them a little more power to do what they'd like to do and may not be encouraged to do. I'm trying to be diplomatic about this. But, yeah, a lot of people have wells that they've been using for decades or longer, and they shouldn't be drinking the water now, often because of nitrates in the water, which really makes it basically poisonous to infants. But also, it's not good for anybody to drink water with high nitrates. It's associated with all kinds of health problems and cancer and so on. So, yeah.
They're going to have to step up. Eugene and Viola, let's go to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
That area from Steuben down to Waseca, the river, Kickapoo River, swings a big horseshoe bend and comes back into Waseca. And that is just plain gorgeous during the summer. They built a railroad. They started the spring of 1892 out of Waseca, and they brought the first train into Lafarge in 1897. And they had 34 bridges, and they had to go through that swampland.
It was quite a comment on that. Yeah, that's a quite a story, Eugene. Comment, Reggie?
Well, I don't know much about that railroad, but you know, it wasn't that long ago that was a principal method of transportation, really, especially if you wanted to haul any crops or anything in bulk. I know that valley is another incredible resource, and it's interesting that there's so much protected land that's connected to the refuge. And so the Kickapoo is largely, you know, public land now, I think, pretty much almost all the way up to the state park, the Wildcat Mountain State Park. And so it's a huge area of public land now, and that's an interesting story in itself, why it's like that. And the backwaters around Waseca are just amazing. I've paddled around in those. But then the lower Wisconsin River is a basically a refuge that's protected too. So the refuge is a wonderful resource, but it's connected to so much protected and wild land on the Chippewa River, too, as well as the Wisconsin River and several other rivers.
Yeah.
And then you have the tertiary or secondary tributary then with the Kickapoo River, too, which is developed into quite an amazing place.
Absolutely. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Louise in Dodgeville, we'll go to you. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
We lost her. Her question was about, is there really a Driftless National Park?
No, there isn't. And that's another interesting story. There was an attempt last fall to establish one kind of in the Whitewater Valley in Minnesota, which is the area between, say, Winona and Rochester. There are thousands and thousands of acres of public land there, and the backwaters where it flows into the Mississippi has a large area of public lands and prairie and so on. And the weather man on a television station in Rochester was pushing the idea of turning it into a national park. And he got very quickly, a lot of people reacted negatively to that for a number of reasons. Principally, you know, they were worried about eminent domain being used to seize farmland and so on. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, sports people, and I've fished on the Whitewater quite a few times. We can do that now without having a pass or, again, paying a fee or, you know. So national parks tend to have more limited access than we have out there. And I think a lot of people were concerned about that, too. So that idea was dropped. There was an earlier idea about having a national park in Grant County in Wisconsin, too. And that didn't get much traction either. You know, and I can kind of understand that, because in a way it's a lot easier to use the public land around here and on the refuge than it is to visit a national park, I mean, frankly. And if you tried to fence and controlled access to some of these places, it would could be nightmarish, I suspect.
Reggie McLeod, our guest today, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, the January-February issue out now. Great to have him with us. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at life along the Mississippi River with Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Dave in Toma. Dave, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm really happy with your guest this morning. I love him and the people you have from the DNR on there. He's got a great platform to promote saving these areas by promoting moratoriums on new roads and sanitary permits so that we don't lose these areas. And that would be a painless thing to do that I think a lot of generations would appreciate in the future.
Yeah. Dave, thanks for calling. Comment, Reggie.
Yeah. Well, I should emphasize that our purpose is to do good regional journalism. So we don't advocate any specific policy or solution, but we try to publish a lot of information about the problems and about the possible solutions and what other people are doing and are maybe not doing in regard to some of these problems. So we want this to be a healthy area both for the people and the land and the wildlife, and that's kind of our mission as doing good journalism, but we're not going to generally take sides. We really want to get all the information out there so people can make better decisions.
Freshwater, before we go back to the phones, I wanted to just mention the freshwater mussels. Many are in danger. Many species in North America are imperiled or even extinct. But a team in Dubuque, and you write about this, has a plan to help mussels. What are they doing?
Well, there's a couple places that are doing a lot of research and work on freshwater mussels. And one is the fish hatchery in Genoa, Wisconsin, and also at the National Mississippi River Aquarium and Museum in Dubuque. They've also been doing a lot of research, and that museum is right on a little natural inlet on the river called Ice Harbor, and they've been monitoring mussels in Ice Harbor for a number of years now, and in kind of building programs to extend their research. And a lot of people are working in kind of planting mussels in places where they have disappeared, but where they used to thrive. So they're doing that sort of work there too, the research and actually and restoration.
And they're doing it because mussels are a part of the river's ecosystem and kind of an important part.
Yeah, it all fits together. You know, we used to see a lot of species as being individual things, and you just restore one part of it. Well, okay, I'm going to back up a little bit. To restore any species, we've kind of learned that you have to restore the habitat first, because if you just throw the animal out in a place where it's not supported by the rest of the ecosystem, it won't thrive, it won't reproduce. So freshwater mussels are an important part of what sustains fish and plants. They filter things out of the water. A lot of them reproduce in cooperation with a specific species of fish. So you need a specific type of fish to be there for the mussels to be able to reproduce. So they're an important niche in the river ecology that's vanished because of water quality, but also people used to harvest mussels to make buttons. So if you look at, if you have a shirt of buttons with buttons on it, which is becoming less popular all the time, but if you do and you look at those buttons, chances are those plastic buttons are made to look like mother of pearl.
Yeah.
That's because, 100 years ago, most of the buttons people had were actually made out of freshwater mussels, and a disproportionate share of those mussels were harvested from the Mississippi River and turned into buttons in the river towns, Prairie du Chien and Lake City, Minnesota, and Muscatine, Iowa was the biggest button manufacturer in the world. I think they were really cranking them out there. The alleys were filled with mussel shells with holes in them where they had drilled out the buttons. So that's why we're trying to restore them now, is because that had an enormous impact on the populations.
Grayson in Ontario, Wisconsin, will give you a chance. Hi, Grayson.
Hi there, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm 77 years old, and I grew up in the Kickapoo Valley. I moved away at age 17 because there was no way to make a living here. And I didn't want to starve like my dad did on the farm. So I left, and I moved back, 20, 25 years ago. And, it's a wonderful place. I feel at home. It's a beautiful scenery out my door. I own a little land with the trout stream on it, some of the best deer hunting in the country. So the land has stayed the same except for the woodland. When I was a child, we had no wildlife, but when the farmers quit pasturing the woodland, everybody, all the wildlife came back, and now we have a lot more deer than what we really need. But the land has changed a little, but the social fabric has changed a lot. I have a few native neighbors, but most of my neighbors no longer live here. There are wealthy people from the city that have bought up all the land. And all the land, when I was a kid, you could walk for miles and miles and nobody cared.
Yeah. Grayson, thanks for calling. So the land hasn't changed much, but the social society climate has changed, Reggie.
Yeah. I agree. I've only lived here about 50 years, so I haven't noticed it that much. No, I actually have. And you do see a lot more no trespassing signs in this, but there's also a lot of public land. I think that's part of the balance. I when I first moved out here, I would just hike around and explore things, and I like creeks and so on. And, I could tell people didn't have their land posted, so I could walk on it, but people had it keeping an eye on me, and you could tell, you could kind of feel I was kind of a suspicious character. And so I hadn't fished much since I was in my early teens, but I started carrying around a fly rod when I go on hikes, and that made me invisible to people, and because they thought, oh yeah, it's another trout fisherman. And then I started trout fishing again, and so I do that a lot now. But I've noticed that, and what I would like to see personally is to have a healthier economy in some places around here. And when COVID hit, a lot of people were working from home, and I think generally, that a lot of people would move out of the big cities and work from their home in the country. They could sell a house in Madison and probably buy three houses in Crawford County or over here around Winona, and not that many people did that. And I thought the small towns would thrive because of that. And Some have had a little bump, but it hasn't had the effect that we expected. And they still can't build houses fast enough in the big cities. And you know, Larry, what home prices are like in the Madison area. And
yes.
For miles around Madison, actually. And you have places like Organic Valley that have created big international businesses in the Driftless area. I mean, that happens a bit. And in Minnesota, you have Mayo Clinic over there that employs a lot of people in the rural areas. But there are a lot of places where it's hard to get a job, and housing is cheap. Land isn't cheap anymore, though. It seems like land isn't cheap anywhere. I bought 40 acres with a house. It wasn't very good cropland. It was mostly hillside. I think we paid $20,000 for it. And this was in the late 70s, probably 76 or 70. Yeah, I think 76. And something like that now would cost 10 or 15 times as much.
Yeah.
You know, if you were to buy that now. So it's kind of, I don't know how you fix things like that, but I would like to see a change somehow.
Grayson, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Barb in Milwaukee has a different kind of question here, I think. Barb, hi.
Good morning. My question is, we have a camper, a really small one, like 10 by 6 or something, rustic teardrop camper. And my question is there any, where do you recommend going camping in that neck of the woods? We tend to go like along the Lake Michigan area, but we haven't gone out to the southwest side of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, there's a lot of wonderful places. You know, just in the Wisconsin state parks, Wild Lucene is a terrific state park. Down there by Prairie du Chien on the Wisconsin River, that's the first place I saw the Mississippi River from, was when I was camping down there many years ago. Perot State Park is great. What's the park in Cassville? I used to go.
It's not coming to me.
Yeah, I'll think of it when I stop trying.
And or somebody will call and tell us.
Yeah, Merrick State Park up river of Fountain City, Wisconsin, is a great park on the river. Some of these, like Trempealeau and Merrick, you can actually have a campsite that's right on the water, and you can bring your canoe and just leave it there and go out and paddle around and fish and explore.
Lots of good places. So, and you've just mentioned three really good ones. So,
Well, in the park in Cassville that we can't remember the name of, is you can get walk-in sites there that you're out right on the edge of the bluff. And I've been out there in the spring during the migration, and it's just I'm not a heavy birder, but my partner is, and she just would go crazy out there when the birds are migrating because they're stopping at our campsite, you know, all the time. It's just amazing.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just quickly, there are a lot of county parks, too, on the river that are very inexpensive to stay at on both sides, and state parks in all four of the states. But Wisconsin has some really, really great ones, yeah.
Barb, you could almost head straight west from Milwaukee, and you'd be right. You just keep going until you hit the river. You're going to find some places, but those are all good places that Reggie's mentioned, and you really ought to take a look. A listener called to recommend the Kickapoo Valley Resort as a place. So, just now. So they're there, and I hope you take a look at it. And if you go to travelwisconsin.com too, you're gonna type those things in, or just take a look at our state maps.
Yeah, and the Great River Road too.
Yeah, Great River Road is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I love that in the fall.
They have a lot of information too online.
Yeah, there is a lot of good information. So you got some things to work on here. Probably keep you busy for, 10, 20 years.
Yeah, and then there's Nelson Dewey State Park in Cassville.
There it is. No, we should remember that one, Nelson Dewey State Park. That's another great one, the one we couldn't remember the name of. Thanks, Barb. And you've probably given some other people some ideas about where to go.
Oh, well, I hope so. Yeah,
I hope so as well. Well, canoeing's come up a couple times. I wanted to go back to one piece. We have hardly talked about many of the stories. There's so many great stories in this issue of Big River. One I liked was quite a long story about some guys who canoed in a race on the Mississippi, and they four guys in one canoe, and they broke a record.
Yeah, they did the entire length of the Mississippi River from up in Lake Itasca, almost up to Canada, all the way to the Gulf of Mexico in less than 17 days, and they were paddling, you know, that's almost 2,400 miles, and they were paddling around the clock. They averaged 138 miles a day. They were paddling in shifts. And just to put that 138 miles a day in perspective, when I paddle 20 miles in a day, I'm done.
Yeah.
it's hard to even imagine it. It's pretty impressive.
They had, it was very well organized, because along the way they'd have people catch up with them or whatever, and they had food set up so that people would supply them with food as they kept going, and they'd maybe all four be paddling, but then sometimes one or two would just fall asleep in the canoe, and it's quite an amazing story.
Yeah, they were in that canoe that whole time, that whole almost 17 days. And they were delivering their food and sleeping and going to the bathroom and the canoe, and they had a team kind of following them along the river in boats and with I think a van, and it was one of the most impressive things besides the physical feat of doing that is the logistics. You know, to support it and keep them moving constantly. You know?
And I think they did a video, which will probably wind up as a little short special or something, I would imagine.
Yeah, I haven't heard a follow-up about that. Generally, when people do something like that, they write a book and or make a video. And I would be surprised if there isn't one coming out, but I haven't heard anything about that yet. But it'll be in Big River when it does. So
yeah, you wrote another piece about the ferries on the Mississippi. Man, there's quite a history of the ferries on the Mississippi River.
Yeah, I had never thought about it much, and I was asked to give a talk on ferries on a ferry down in the Quad Cities this spring. And so I thought, I don't know anything about ferries. And so I had to become a quick study, and really I learned a lot. And it was fascinating, and I'm still learning about these. I had taken the Cassville Ferry, which you can take to the Nelson Dewey State Park. No, there's the only ferry on our stretch of the river that's still operating is at Cassville, and they would really like to have a bridge across the river there, because it's about 60 miles from Prairie du Chien to Dubuque, and they're right in the middle. So when the ferry can't run in the winter and when the water's high and that, it's really kind of a burden for them. But, yeah, they have a lovely ferry that stays busy. It's a lot of people just probably take the ferry and turn around and come back on the ferry, because it's a nice little boat ride, but it only takes about 15 minutes or so to get across. But there were ferries that were powered by horses walking on treadmills and all kinds of crazy things that I found out about. The most amazing ones were powered by the current, actually. They would just turn the ferry boat a little bit on an angle, and the current would push it to one side, and then they'd turn to the other angle, and the current would push it to the other side. So, I mean, that's so brilliant.
Oh, man.
Yeah, talk about green energy.
There it was. Well, it's a fascinating story. Tom in Cross Plains has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Great that I was able to call in. The Driftless is such a beautiful transition environmentally from the North Woods and the Great Lakes to the prairies and the Mississippi River. And that edge area promotes a very interesting biotic community. It also promoted a lot of interesting conservation writers. And the Driftless brought us Aldo Leopold, John Muir, Augie Derleth, Hamlin Garland, Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's been a great area to promote people's understanding of the environment.
Tom, right. And Reggie McLeod. You didn't mention Reggie, but Reggie McLeod's another one of those writers. Comment, Reggie?
Someday. You know, that's so true. It's amazing. And we've been doing this for 31 years now. And sometimes people ask me where we get our ideas. And, you know, the ideas come in faster than we can do the stories. We have no lack of ideas for new stories that we haven't done before. I mean, this is such an amazing place culturally as well as geologically and the natural systems and so on. I can understand why writers were inspired by this. I know I certainly am, and a lot of the people that write for Big River Magazine feel that way too. So, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is important. And there are a few names that we left off here, but people are still writing about it, even beyond Big River Magazine. It's still a good subject.
How do people get Big River Magazine?
Well, they can go to our website, which is called BigRiverMagazine.com. So that should be easy to remember. Or they can call us at on the phone at 1-800-303-8201. Or they can go to Wisconsin Public Radio online, and you guys might have a link to our site there.
Yeah, we do. I'm pretty sure we have a link on today's date, ideas at wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date. But otherwise, if you just type in Big River Magazine, you're going to learn about it, or, again, that 1-800-303-8201. Reggie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Oh, always appreciate it.
Thanks. I enjoy it so much. I like talking about this.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And we didn't touch on even a tenth of the stories that are in the magazine this time around. Well, weather is always on our minds. It's always on my mind the last Monday of the month, because that's when our weather guys come along to talk weather and climate. Today we got weather guy, Steve Ackerman, up next to talk weather and climate. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.